Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the legacy of white and Native American intermarriage, and how have different generations of mixed-race families navigated their personal identities and their relationships to their loved ones and the communities in which they live? Having longed to explore those questions, my guest was excited to stumble upon the Clark family, which first united white and Native American members in the mid-19th century with the marriage of a fur trader with European roots and the teenage daughter of a Piegan Blackfoot warrior. As we'll hear in this hour, their union was the beginning of a long, complex, and sometimes brutal family history. Andrew R. Graybill is Associate Professor of History and Director of the William P. Clements Center for Southwest Studies at SMU. His new book is called The Red and the White, A Family Saga of the American West. Andy, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you had read, this is so interesting, you'd read about Malcolm Clark in a novel, thought, what an interesting character, but you didn't know for sure that he was a real person.
Exactly. So there's a tremendous piece of historical fiction called Fool's Crow, written by the Blackfoot author James Welch, published in the mid-1980s. It's a great teaching tool I've discovered for undergraduates because it gives them a perspective from the Indian sensibility about what the invasion of their country looked like by whites in the period after the Civil War and during Reconstruction. So I'd read the book a number of times and taught it, and I knew that, of course, it was based on real events. But when I stumbled across the story of Malcolm Clark, that wasn't nearly as familiar to me as the Marias Massacre. And so I wondered if Welch had invented him to move the story along. Mm.
And how did you actually realize, okay, this is a real person and a lot of the basic facts are what I thought they were?
Right. So I actually was in Montana in the summer of 2006 on a very different research assignment. I was researching another sort of obscure episode that I was interested in writing a book about. But I was pretty bored with that in the early going, which is never a good sign.
Right.
So I stepped away one day and started digging around in the archives. And in deciding where to look, I thought instantly of Fool's Crow, since I just taught it recently at the University of Nebraska, where I was then employed. So with the help from the archivists there, I bumped around a little bit and was curious to find if Malcolm Clark was indeed a real person. And sure enough, very quickly, within a few keystrokes, turned out that there was a microfilm reel and a vertical file containing a lot of biographical information. Plus, the Clarks were really well known to folks at the Montana Historical Society. Everybody knew the Clarks. So I was the latecomer, and they were very kind to say, yes, indeed, he's for real, and so is his family.
What makes this particular family such a good lens through which to view this really complicated question of white and Native American intermarriage, which, of course, you can't entirely generalize about this?
Right. Well, one thing I'd say is I think there are multiple families that one might be able to use to tell such a story. The Clarks are so useful for a couple of reasons. For one, there's ample documentation. Mm-hmm. There are never enough sources for the historian as he or she might like, or at least not for those who work on the 19th century like me. But there was ample archival and secondary material on various members of the family. So they were great in that regard. But probably even more important is the fact that they're bound up in these really critical events in the history of not only Montana, but the wider West, so that I could use them and the paper trail they generated to tell this story, even if some of the questions about, say, the Marias Massacre. Those are important, but they're not central. This is really a story about the formation of racial identity.
So how did this guy Malcolm Clark, who had dreamed of a military career initially, end up as a fur trader in the Midwest?
By having a really hot temper. I think it might be the easiest way to get to that. So Clark is born into a military family in 1817 in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's raised at Fort Snelling, which is now in present-day downtown Minneapolis, St. Paul. So he had this sort of strenuous life upbringing and had distinguished himself as somebody who was a crack shot with a gun. And he developed some other attitudes there as well, among them dueling. But at any rate, so Clark spends his formative years in Fort Snelling, but his father, who himself had not really been born to privilege, was very concerned that Malcolm not have to climb as painfully through the military ranks, and so orchestrated a position for Malcolm at West Point. He arrives in 1834. By the spring of the following year, he's been expelled for the first of two times for a violent episode, and then although he's miraculously reinstated by Andrew Jackson, a friend of the family, Clark can't stay out of his own way, and so the following year he gets involved in a second fight, is court-martialed, and is expelled for the second and final time. And without many prospects, he makes his way to Texas and eventually to the Upper Missouri River to try his hand in the fur trade.
Talk about, you know, we hear the fur trade now, and it sounds sort of quaint, but this was a tremendous industry in the American West, and help us understand why and what the significance of it was.
Almost like the study of the range cattle industry in the 1870s and 1880s, there are groaning bookshelves that that describe a relatively brief period in the nation's past. I think the fur trade is really important because, as a number of historians have written, this is a way in which Americans from an early point in the 19th century really paved the way for what becomes the American Empire. I think that's its historical significance. Why folks have written so much about it is because it is hopelessly romantic. You've got these rather scattered individuals in this enormous landscape chasing these or trapping these really sort of majestic creatures, first beaver and then bison. So it has historical significance, but also I think plays to our romantic sensibilities.
Okay, so Clark is sort of building up his career in this field. Meanwhile, a young woman is growing up. Not as much is written about her, in part, at least her childhood, in part because she is a woman.
Right, and Native. She's really hard to track. Of the five characters, I built the book around five members across three generations of this family, and Kothkokonam, which is her name, which translates as cutting off head woman. Precisely what that means, I don't know. I've heard sort of different explanations. But at any rate, she is, like many Native peoples of the time, she doesn't really pop up in the historical records, at least the ones that are pretty accessible to historians. So she's born probably around 1825, and she turns up here and there, particularly later in her life after her husband is murdered, is when she starts to, you see more regular mention of her. But it was pretty hard to track her story. She was the most elusive. So I do a lot of that through context, what I know about Blackfoot history at that time.
So what you do know is that a woman of her station and born to a warrior father would have been trained from an early age to tan hides.
Exactly. This is probably the most, well, easily the most important skill that a young woman is going to learn in a variety of Plains Indian societies and from the mid-18th century into the late 19th century, how to tan a buffalo hide, because it's critical both for provisioning native economies in terms of building lodges, teepees, but also for the buffalo provided, walking commissary provided all sorts of implements and tools. But the buffalo becomes even more important as a commercial product, as buffalo robes and skins become increasingly important and coveted in urban markets in the East and overseas. And so a Native woman, that is what she is expected to do from a relatively early age, along with a whole host of other duties.
And those hides could be traded for, I mean, they could be sold, but they could also be traded for things like guns and tools that weren't available sort of from the land.
Exactly. And this is really how natives and newcomers interact in the North American West. I mean, this is true from the 17th century when the French arrive and start pushing into what is now sort of central and western Canada. It's true certainly in the American West as well, that this exchange is absolutely central to how we understand, to the history of Native societies at this time. And they get many things out of it, without doubt. Guns are critical when they emerge in the mid-18th century, plus all kinds of manufactured goods, tea kettles, ammunition, liquor, and so on. But there's also a really dark underside to the dependence on those goods.
So put the Piegan Blackfeet into context for us in the sort of broader region of the Plains and tell us a little bit about them specifically.
Sure. One of my hopes in writing the book is that they will be restored a bit to the conversation about Plains Indian societies. They were, at least according to really reputable anthropologists and ethnographers of the early to mid-20th century, the most important and powerful Indian nation on the northwestern plains. So west of the Sioux, if listeners can envision a map of the central U.S., if the Sioux are in South Dakota and in eastern Montana, the Blackfeet, their territory is from the Saskatchewan River in Canada to the Teton Range in Wyoming and then east of the Rocky Mountains. And they become the most powerful nation on the northwestern plains during the really from the late 18th century to their effective collapse, economic collapse in the late 19th century through great leadership, bravery in battle, and of course, a very rich landscape from which to draw provisions.
So it's fairly obvious why a young white man who had come from farther east would be interested in marrying a native woman, because there weren't a lot of white women. There weren't a lot of women, you know, sort of available to them. Why would Kothkokona's father and mother have approved of her marrying somebody like Malcolm Clark?
Well, sadly, her mother probably wouldn't have had a lot of say in it. It would have been her father, Underbull, who made most of these choices, or all of these choices, really. And the reasons are pretty simple. It's an economic sort of relationship, first and foremost, because you're right. For the white man, it's pretty obvious what he would get out of such a relationship. Companionship, first and foremost, where there were no white women from which he might otherwise have chosen. But there was an economic benefit for both parties. For the white trader who married a native woman, he was able to secure access to his father-in-law and male-in-laws, the very best pelts and hides and animal products that they could gather or hunt for him. Conversely, for the Indian man who married his daughter to a white fur trader, what he got was access to the trader's manufactured goods, the iron kettles, the knives, the guns, the ammunition and liquor, which is useful in its own right for consumption, but maybe even more useful in being able to distribute his patronage, which would help such a man be able to secure a position of authority in the tribe. So there's a real economic underpinning.
So would the Clarks, after they married, have communicated with one another exclusively in English?
No, in Blackfeet. I suspect that, I don't know this to be certain, but I don't think Kothkokona spoke much English at all. Clark spoke Piegan and he spoke Sioux, and he spoke English and French. So I suspect that most of their, maybe all of their dealings were in the Indian tongue.
So what do we know about their home life together, where they lived and the children they had and how they raised them?
Right. So they live at a handful of important American Fur Company posts scattered throughout central Montana along the Missouri River and its tributaries, the most important of which were for the Clarks were Fort McKenzie, which is a satellite post of the most important AFC post, Fort Union. Fort McKenzie is, you know, sort of in the central part of the of what is now the state of Montana. But also it's some satellites as well. Clark was pretty effective, and so very effective. So he would often be sent to get a new satellite post up and running. And so Clark and Kothkokona lived throughout central Montana. At Fort Benton later on after 1847, which becomes the most important not only AFC post but sort of entrepot for goods and people on the northern plains. And they have children, starting in 1848 with the birth of their daughter Helen, followed by Horace the next year in 1849, Nathan in 1852, and Isabel in 1861. Those are the ones we know about. It's almost certain that they lost other children in childbirth or in infancy.
Mm-hmm. But they seem to have gotten along all right. You mentioned that Malcolm Clark had this terrible temper, but it didn't extend, I guess, to the women in his life.
Right. Economics were clearly chief in shaping the relationships between white men and Indian women in fur country. But I also have little doubt that the Clark and Kothkokona had a relationship that was built also on love. I don't want to over-romanticize that, but the fact that they stayed together for 25 years, the fact that that they had these children and Clark held the family together. Very often, white fur traders, after their time in the fur trade had played out, would move back to the eastern United States, and they would abandon their so-called country wives and their children, which to a parent like me is unfathomable. But Clark chose to stay in fur country, and it had lasting consequences.
We're speaking this hour with Andrew R. Graybill, who is Associate Professor of History and Director of the William P. Clements Center for Southwest Studies at SMU. His new book is called The Red and the White, A Family Saga of the American West. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Andrew R. Graybill, Associate Professor of History and Director of the William P. Clement Center for Southwest Studies at SMU. His new book is called The Red and the White, A Family Saga of the American West. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send a tweet to @ChrisBoydThink. Okay, so Andy, we will talk about some of the children that the Clarks had, but I do want to get to the events that led up to the Marias Massacre. How did it happen that Malcolm Clark was violently killed at the age of 52?
52, yes. Mm-hmm. So the best way to answer this probably is to say that Montana experienced a real social transformation in the 1860s, marked by the influx of white outsiders, folks who were coming west to avoid the turmoil of the Civil War, but also people who had heard rumors that proved to be true of a series of gold strikes. So you've got a rapid influx of white outsiders into this pretty precariously balanced society, this fragile society that's developed in Montana, where there is room for people of mixed ancestry. This happens in the early 1860s, and one Pekin elder whom I spoke to on the reservation described it as like water over a rock in terms of the number of whites who fled into the territory. And there are a number of conflicts between these white newcomers and the Pekins who lived there. At any rate, that's the backdrop. Clark is killed with that as the historical backdrop on August 17th, 1869, by an Indian named Natushio, whom the whites called Pete Owlchild, who comes to his house with a handful of others. Cousin of Clark's Pekin wife, Kothka Kona, surprising late night visit, but not unusual or totally out of the picture because they're family. Mm-hmm. Clark invites them in. They have dinner around the table, although some years later, Malcolm's daughter Helen recalled that the mood around the table was odd in hindsight. After dinner, Clark was invited outside onto the porch at his ranch to have a smoke by Owlchild. And as they stepped outside, another Indian bolted from the brush and shot Clark in the chest at point-blank range. And as he fell backwards, Owlchild cleaved his forehead with an axe and so killed him right on the spot in front of his family.
Why did they kill him?
Well, the reasons for that are still a subject of some debate. Helen wrote a rather lengthy piece about her father, which focused a lot on his murder, but it was a larger biographical piece. And she says, this is from the 1880s, I believe, and the story has been repeated a number of times ever since, this is a festering dispute over some stolen horses and a spyglass. That certainly seems possible. But folks that I spoke to on the reservation up in Montana suggest that actually what had happened was that Clark had assaulted Owlchild's wife when they had visited on a previous occasion a couple of years before, and that this was payback for that.
Okay, so there's his death was viewed as payback perhaps by other Pekins, and then the U.S. cavalry came. And did they respond with the force that they did because Malcolm Clark was Malcolm Clark, or simply because he was a white man killed by Native Americans?
Sort of a whole kind of stew of ingredients that go into the response. I think you really can't understand it without thinking about the turmoil in Montana in the 1860s. So the fact that you've got this low-level grinding guerrilla war between white newcomers and Pekins has got the military on high alert. But Clark is an especially notable figure. Only a few years before, he and a handful of other white men like him had founded the Montana Historical Society to honor white men like themselves. And so he was very prominent and very well known. And his murder, which was brazen and conducted on his homestead, on his ranch, just 25 miles north of Helena, which is the territorial capital, led many to believe that no whites were safe in Montana because Clark seemed to be perfectly insulated against such kinds of violence. He was married to an Indian woman, had children of mixed ancestry, was known by many to be a friend to the Indians. So his murder was very jarring to white residents of the territory, especially those who had recently arrived. And that is what gets the military's attention.
So what was it like in the latter half of the before we go there, let's talk about the response, because you've referred multiple times to the Marias massacre.
Right.
And it was indeed a massacre. In fact, the people that were victimized by the cavalry were in large part in no condition to even defend themselves.
Right. It's really tragic. So after Clark's murder, the military pursues a two-part strategy with the carrot and the stick. The carrot part doesn't work out too well, largely because of the Indians' inability, because the Piegans were scattered during the winter for them to be able to round up Pete Owlchild and the others. But the military threatens them with retaliation if they don't deliver Owlchild and the other murderers and some stolen horses and mules. The Indians try, but are unsuccessful in doing so. And so General Phil Sheridan orders one of his proteges, Eugene M. Baker, who had distinguished himself during the Civil War and the Shenandoah, into action with the 2nd U.S. Cavalry, which heads out from Fort Shaw in central Montana on January 19th, 1870. Brutal four-day march, marching during the night, holed up during the day so that they would not be spotted. And then on the morning of the fourth day, discover an encampment that they believe to be harboring the guilty Indians, the Big Bend and the Marias River.
Did they have good evidence of this, or did they just find an encampment and think, that's it, let's just do this?
Well, they had a very good scout named Joe Kipp, who himself was of mixed ancestry, although not Blackfoot. His mother was Mandan, and his father was a white trader named James Kipp. And Joe Kipp was very familiar with the countryside and the people, certainly knew the Blackfeet well, and believed that he had found a Mountain Chief's band. Mountain Chief was perhaps the most recalcitrant Piegan leader at the time, very resistant to white encroachment, and he was believed to be harboring Owlchild. So Kipp believed that he had found Mountain Chief's encampment at the Big Bend in the Marias. But as he has led the 400 members of the U.S. 2nd Cavalry, along with a handful of concerned citizens, among them Horace Clark and his brother Nathan, who had come to avenge their father, as the sun comes up on January 23rd, 1870, with the cavalry arrayed on the bluffs overhead, Kipp realizes that the markings on the central teepee are not a Mountain Chief's, but actually belong to Heavy Runner, who was a noted peace chief whom the troops had been explicitly instructed to avoid. And Major Baker, upon learning of this, decided to go ahead and proceed with the assault anyway. And so a great tragedy ensued.
And how many people were killed?
So 173 is the official tally from the U.S. military. The Indians insist it was 217, mostly women, children, and the elderly, because all the able-bodied men were off on a buffalo hunt looking for any sort of sustenance they could provide for the camp, partly because it was in the dead of winter, brutal Montana winter, 30 and 40 degrees below zero. But they were also really eager to find food because the camp was starving and the people inside of it, many of them were suffering from smallpox. This was unbeknownst to the U.S. troopers at the time. I'm not sure it would have made much of a difference. Mm. But they then shot up the camp with heavy ammunition that was capable of bringing down game, and they shot up the lodges, but they also shot the bindings off of the teepee so that those tents collapsed on the cooking fires within, so suffocating or incinerating the inhabitants inside. So, and then they charged with their sabers.
Reading about this is so upsetting, and you think about the number of people, even if you believe the lower military figure. And it struck me that I had not heard of the Marias Massacre. And is that because there was some cover-up or because things like this happened so frequently that only a few of them have remained with us through education down through the centuries?
Mm. Well, I had the same question. It's one of the things that motivated me. Why was the Marias Massacre, or why is it so comparatively obscure, especially when you think about it in relation to, say, Sand Creek in 1864 and Wounded Knee in 1890, which are infamous and sort of the bookends of this the so-called Indian Wars of the Great Plains. I think the Marias is obscure. It was not covered up. There was it was definitely some congressional. To call it an investigation is probably a bit much. But to say that word trickled back, it most definitely did.
And the New York Times reported on it.
As did a number of other publications, some of them favorably. The folks in Montana were thrilled that this had happened because they were furious at the Piegans and wanted their land. But as to why it is unknown today, I think there are a couple of reasons. I think one of them is because Montana, even if Sand Creek and eastern Colorado is not exactly close to anything, it's still sort of within the orbit of Denver. The Marias Massacre, the site of the massacre is extremely remote. And so I think the fact that it's so removed from anything like a decent-sized settlement, even with the Telegraph and reporters who might have been able to gather information on this, I think its location is obscure. But I also think that that part of it is because, just as you say, this is a particularly horrific episode, but there are a number of these events, and this one happened to come between two that are much more famous and probably much more definitive in defining American Indian policy.
It was interesting to me. You quote a little bit of that New York Times editorial, and I don't want to overplay its importance. And back then, it was a local paper and not a national paper, and all of that. But I think sometimes we assume that every white person in America just wanted the Indians cleared out. And it's very clear that there was debate, even if one side kept winning, there was debate over the kind of abuse that was being subjected upon Native populations of this country.
Right. One of the things that certainly is important about the Marias Massacre and its timing is the fact that it's 1870. And so the folks, particularly people like William Lloyd Garrison and Wendell Phillips and Lydia Maria Child, who were intimately associated with the abolitionist movement, many of them turned their attention to the terrible treatment of Indians, you know, after the Civil War. Certainly they were interested in this beforehand, but with emancipation, of course, the 13th and 14th Amendment, the abolitionists were able to turn their energies to other causes. And that's one of the reasons why this gets so much attention. I think the split tends to be geographic. People in the East, Phil Sheridan makes exactly this point, as does William T. Sherman, which is that if those humanitarians in the East could come and spend a little time with a military garrison in the West, they might have had different ideas about Indians. But those voices are really important in changing American Indian policy in the late 19th century.
So you mentioned that Horace and Nathan were among those who accompanied the cavalry to avenge their father's death. Horace, for the rest of his life, had sort of conflicted feelings about his own identity as a Piegan, and yet he married a Piegan woman, right? And lived in the community.
He does. Horace is curious this way. He rides with the cavalry. He and his brother take their revenge against their own blood relatives, uncles and cousins. But Horace essentially becomes one of them, one of the Piegans, in the years after the massacre. He marries Margaret Firstkill, who, as you mentioned, is a full-blooded Piegan woman. He takes an allotment on the Blackfeet Reservation in the late 19th, early 20th century, even serves on the Blackfoot Tribal Council, which is sort of the tribe's governing body. On the other hand, he never apologizes for his role in the Marias Massacre. I think many Piegans gave him something of a pass because his father had been murdered and also because the family was prominent and the Clarks had done a lot of good for their mixed and full-blooded brethren. But he gives an interview sometime in the 1920s to a white historian, sort of amateur historian, in which he explains that he does acknowledge that the wrong camp was struck, Heavy Runner's camp and not Mountain Chief's, and also that that Baker and many of his men were drunk, as he put it memorably in this deposition. The troops, quote, kept their spirits up by taking spirits down. But he himself never apologized for his role.
Was he fully accepted despite the fact that he had one white parent?
I think he was. I think that racial identity was a bit more fluid in the mid to late 19th century. And so I'm not sure what kind of distinctions were actually drawn on the reservation between Horace and Helen and people of full blood. On the other hand, the fact that they were of mixed ancestry, many people, including the Clarks, knew that they were in a particular position to be able to influence tribal politics, particularly in relationship to dealings with representatives of the federal government, who were always more comfortable dealing with people who were of mixed ancestry, believing that they were more competent, frankly, to be able to help negotiate tribal affairs and to steer their full-blooded relatives and friends.
And that certainly plays into the history of Helen Clark, who is, I think, just such a fascinating character that she almost deserves her own book. Tell us a little bit about her early career. We'll start there. Tell us about her early career.
Well, if there's one character in the book who really convinced me that this was a story that I wanted to write, it was Helen, because her life is so extraordinary. She's born in 1848, and after her father's murder, which she witnesses, in fact, she has very haunting memories of packing Horace's wounds. Horace is shot in the face that same night and miraculously survives. And Helen plays a key role in stanching his wounds with raw tobacco and preserving him, basically, helping to save him. But after her father's murder, she heads east, and she has a brief but acclaimed stage career on Broadway, where she stars alongside the famous French actress Sarah Bernhardt. And Helen apparently had a terrific stage presence. She was, as one contemporary described her, and I love this, quote, 5 feet 10 inches of magnificent womanhood, which I think is brilliant.
And you have photographs of her in the book. She was beautiful.
She was indeed. And she apparently had a very deep and sonorous voice, which made her especially effective stage performer. She heads back to Montana around 1875 for reasons that aren't entirely clear. And then begins work as a teacher. Not unusual. She had a very good education, Catholic schools in Minneapolis and Cincinnati. But then has sort of the second, I think, pretty incredible installment in her professional life, which is when she becomes the first woman elected to office in the history of Montana Territory, when she becomes the superintendent of schools for Lewis and Clark County, which is the where Helena is the county seat. So this is the largest and wealthiest county in Montana at that time. She serves in that position for the better part of the 1880s. And then around 1890, takes on what I consider to be the most unusual of her career moves, when she heads to Indian Territory, present-day Oklahoma, and serves as an allotting agent, breaking up the reservations, the communal lands of Indian groups like the Tonkawas, the Poncas, the Otoes, and others. She's only the second woman that I'm aware of who has served in this capacity, and the only person of Native or mixed Native white ancestry who has such responsibility. So she's a sui generis figure in that regard.
My guest is Andrew R. Graybill, Associate Professor of History and Director of the William P. Clements Center for Southwest Studies at SMU. His new book is called The Red and the White, A Family Saga of the American West. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Andrew R. Graybill, who is Associate Professor of History and Director of the William P. Clements Center for Southwest Studies at SMU. His new book is called The Red and the White, A Family Saga of the American West. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So you think about someone like Helen Clark, who obviously is of mixed ancestry, but would clearly be able to relate to the plight of Native Americans, you know, a lot, you know, giving out these allotments and working with the federal government. And in some ways, it makes it sound like she's sort of selling out. And on the other hand, she chose to live out the end of her life on a Piegan allotment very close to where her brother settled.
Right, it's complicated, and it's the contradictions, I guess, that in some ways drew me most powerfully to Helen. So you're right. She goes down to Indian Territory, present-day Oklahoma, in the 1890s, and plays the heavy, effectively, for the federal government. And one of the reasons she particularly is chosen, she's handpicked by the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, which is really unusual, so far as I can tell, is because she has Indian ancestry, and the groups in Oklahoma or in Indian Territory are believed to be some of those most recalcitrant to accepting allotments. And so they believe that Helen, perhaps with her Indian background, might be able to be a more persuasive force. Turns out that not only is that not true, but that many of the Indians resent the fact that, in their words, the government has sent a woman to do a man's job.
Hmm.
But she's still very effective, and she manages throughout. Basically, she's in Oklahoma from 1891 to 1899. She's very effective in deploying the power of the federal government. And at first, I think she is sympathetic in many ways to the plight of many of the Indian peoples with whom she's dealing. But late in her time in the Indian Territory, her frustration becomes evident that these folks won't accept the allotments, don't seem to recognize, or actually do recognize, that this represents progress and modernization, and their very spirit abhors it, as she puts it more or less in a letter. But in the end, what she finds is that when she goes back to Montana, ultimately in the early 20th century, that the door has closed not only on Indian peoples, but also on peoples of mixed ancestry like herself. And I don't think that's true only in Montana. I think that's true throughout the wider West. And so her return to Montana is a pretty painful one.
So Margaret Furskill, wife of Horace, gave birth to a number of children. And you sort of drill down into the story of one remarkable son who, I guess, was left deaf by a childhood illness, but had really astonishing talents as an artist.
Right. So John Clark is the character with whom I conclude the book. And he is the grandson of Malcolm Clark, the son of Horace and Margaret Furskill, and he's Helen's nephew. And he's born in 1881 and is afflicted with scarlet fever, a disease that carries off four or five of his young siblings. He survives but is rendered deaf and mute. But through dint of his own interest and talent, he becomes a world-renowned sculptor of Western wildlife. Largely self-taught, takes a couple of classes, one that I can verify, but starts from an early age making figurines and carvings and sculptures out of mud that he digs from the banks of the Missouri River. And this sort of sets him on a pretty extraordinary path.
His life was really changed when he was given an education and taught to sign.
Right. So for reasons that I can't entirely understand, he's sent not to the institution in Montana, which does exist at that time, for educating people like John who have those kinds of disabilities, but instead to North Dakota, where he learns to sign. Never learns to lip read, but he learns to sign. And this becomes incredibly important in his ability to communicate not only with Indians on the reservation, but also the white people in his world who later become patrons. Earlier in his career, his employers, when he's carving church altars in Milwaukee, where he also spends a little time in an institutional boarding school setting. But his career, as I said, is really it's pretty extraordinary. He may be the most famous of the Clarks.
I love the detail that he combined American Sign Language that he was taught in school with Plains Indian Sign Language, which is not used for necessarily because people don't speak, but because people spoke all these different languages.
Exactly. That develops. I don't know as much as I should about the history of Plains Indian Sign Language, or PISL, as it's usually abbreviated. But it developed on the Plains, I'm going to say, probably at least in the 17th or 18th century, because you've got these wide variety of groups that are inhabiting this this large but not infinite region, groups that speak their own languages. You know, Comanche is different from Sioux, is different from Arapaho, or Cheyenne is different from Blackfoot. So that these groups that are all there on the plains for the same reason, namely to hunt buffalo and to subsist that way. And well, for much of the 18th and 19th centuries, they learned to communicate through a common system of signs and gestures.
So John Clark was three-quarter Piegan anyway, but he completely identified with that part of himself as his career evolved, his work focused more and more on that heritage. And yet he married a white woman, and together they adopted a white child.
Exactly. And he's, I find him really interesting for this. I do see a shift in his career later on to where where I think he really does begin to explore much more explicitly his native identity and his ancestry in that regard. But on the other hand, he does. He marries a white woman, which is the ultimate badge of racial privilege in the West, probably in the United States at that time. And they adopt a white girl, Joyce Clark Turvey, their only child, when they're both in their 40s, pretty unusual. But I see Clark, as I explain in the end of the book, in the epilogue, as 150% man, which I borrowed that concept from an anthropologist named Malcolm McPhee, who realized his insight is that that if somebody measures, say, 75% Indian, and this is not so much in terms of biology, but in terms of culture and outlook, that he shouldn't be limited, or she shouldn't be limited to just, say, 25% whiteness, that in fact you could be powerfully acculturated to two or more traditions simultaneously, and that racial identity, or identity in general, is not a zero-sum calculation. I think Clark really embodies that, as do Helen and Horace, for that matter.
And early in this country's history, Thomas Jefferson thought that the way that we would all sort of come together was by intermarriage. I should say Native American and white.
Yes. So Jefferson
was an important caveat there. Right. With Jefferson. So
Jefferson was, although, again, what's interesting is to measure that against his own experience, sure, and his relationship with Sally Hemings. But in terms of any sort of official promotion of intermarriage, he says very famously to a group of Delaware Indians in 1808 about he exhorts them to intermarriage, saying that our blood will run together and we will become one people and rule over this great island, which I think he means, you know, North America, the United States. And his reasons for that, I think he saw that as a way to obviate conflict. But I also think that was mingled with a real respect for Indian peoples, one that he seems not to necessarily have had for African Americans.
So tell us a little bit more about John Clark's work. He was collected by John D. Rockefeller?
Right. So John D. Rockefeller Jr. comes out. The Rockefellers take in their private rail car in the 1920s a series of trips to iconic sites throughout the West, Grand Canyon. They go to Yellowstone. One summer, I think it's 1924, they go to Glacier National Park, which had opened only 14 years before, 1910. And John Clark quite smartly has a studio just up the road from the rail depot, really within sort of almost within visible distance of the famous Glacier Park Lodge, still in existence today and built on a piece of former Clark family land. We can come back to that or not. But Junior, as he was known in his family, wander on up to Clark's studio, described by one contemporary visitor as a, quote, scene from the animal kingdom, because of all these different sculptures that were in progress. Clark, again, carved lots of mountain goats and lions and grizzly bears and so on. And he came away with quite a haul, apparently, that went into the Rockefeller family art collection.
So tell us about that piece of land that is now Glacier National Park.
So Horace Clark is one of the very first settlers, perhaps the first settler in a town called Midvale in the late 1880s, which later becomes East Glacier Park after the government pries this piece of land away from the Blackfeet with help in part from the Clarks. They're Zelig-like in this regard. They really are everywhere. And Horace secures one of the earliest and best allotments, which is right on the extreme western edge of the reservation, very close to the entrance to the park. And in time, he sells a portion of that allotment to the Great Northern Railway, which builds on it the beautiful Glacier Park Lodge, which is still in existence today, where I imagine some of your listeners have probably stayed.
How controversial is the legacy of the Clark family in the Piegan community now?
That's a really good question. I think that the Clarks are generally very well regarded, with the exception of Malcolm Clark, who I think is seen as someone who, he's tied to the darkest day in Piegan history.
Yeah.
And while I suspect that something brutal would have happened on a large military scale with the Piegans and the U.S. military, given the grinding conflict in the 1860s there, the fact is that it stems directly from Malcolm Clark's murder. The children, on the other hand, and the other descendants, I think, are very well regarded. Helen Clark, especially, even into the early 20th century, was really revered as someone who cared for her people, for her full-blooded kin and friends, whom she realized were facing a very difficult transition to reservation life and federal oversight. And I think Horace Clark as well, even though he was there on the banks of the Marias with his brother firing into that camp, I think that many Piegans today realize that the circumstances that faced him were particular and painful, given the rather brazen murder of his father. And of course, John Clark is much beloved.
Yeah, of course. Can you give me some perspective on this, Andy? Because it seems to me that Americans of mixed ancestry, whether African and Native American or European and Native American, are typically speak about that with great pride. And that sort of flies in the face of the terrible racism and injustice wrought upon Native Americans for so long in this country. Can you help me understand why people can look back and be so proud, and yet for such a long time there was so much going on that now we find just unspeakable?
Right. Well, I think that prejudice that such individuals face comes from the, you know, binary racial calculus in the U.S. that, you know, you belong to one group or another. I think that's changing. If you or your listeners have been following the New York City mayoral campaign, yeah, with Bill de Blasio, who's married to an African American woman, and they have two children of mixed race, and I think that there is a space that's opening up in the U.S. for more tolerance for such people. I think you see that also in the census records that, you know, give people an opportunity to list the variety of racial heritages. But I think that does, in many ways, fly in the face of the prejudice that such folks have faced for much of the 20th century. And I think that the pride perhaps comes from persistence, from the fact that that such people who do feel proud of a dual or mixed ancestry realize they haven't had to sacrifice one or the other, but combine both and live proudly as such.
You actually met Joyce Clark, and forgive me because I can't remember her married surname.
Turvey.
Tell us a little bit about her.
So she was a really sweet and generous woman, and one of the bittersweet parts about the book is that it was just published in October, but Joyce passed away in August, having given me huge amounts of family memorabilia to reproduce in the book, and of course sat with me for a couple of very long interviews. I met Joyce in 2006 when I was doing some research, when I sort of fell down the rabbit hole of the Clark family history. And someone at the Montana Historical Society put me in touch with Joyce, somebody who was on their radar, who had helped curate an exhibition of her father's work in the early 90s at the Historical Society. And Joyce took this call out of the blue, unsolicited from me, chatted with me, seemed a little bit confused, I think. But when we got together, I came back to Montana that fall, we sat down. And she was, I think, delighted to be able to share with me this enormous amount of really beautifully curated information, in part because she was a historian herself. She had done a lot of work on the family in a lot of individual pieces. She hadn't been able to pull it all together. And I think she figured that as she was then in her late 70s, she was going to be unable to. I think she was happy to turn it over to me.
And she was proud, I guess, of her father's history, but identified as white.
She did. She did. Joyce lived most of her life, certainly most of her adult life, her later years, in East Glacier Park. In fact, she opened a studio and art gallery, very small, but with some really beautiful pieces from both her father, which were not for sale, and from local artists, which were, on the site of her father's last studio. And she lived out the rest of her life there. But in talking to some people on the Blackfeet Reservation, they were surprised to discover that Joyce was not Native. They knew all about John Clark. But to me, the fact that they didn't know a whole lot about Joyce suggested that this gulf, which I don't think came from any resentment or bitterness, but I think it just is a gulf between the white and Native worlds, which we see throughout the West, throughout the U.S., had prevented folks from really getting to know her. And so they assumed that she was Indian and were surprised to discover that she was not, which again told me just how far apart those worlds are even today.
Andrew R. Graybill is Associate Professor of History and Director of the William P. Clements Center for Southwest Studies at SMU. His new book is called The Red and the White, A Family Saga of the American West. Andy, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thanks so much, Chris. It was a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Christine McConnell prepares our podcast, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.